We love supporting and promoting the creators of musical theater throughout the world, and we would love to have your support as well. Go to musicaltheaterradio.com and click on the Become a Patron button, because a supportive community is a strong community. Welcome back to another episode of Be Our Guest here on Musical Theater Radio. I am your host, as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. I'm going to admit something right now. I'm not a scientist. I don't know anything about biology or genetics. So if you're writing a dissertation or doctoral thesis on this subject, please don't quote me on anything I'm about to say. But today's guest, I think, is good proof that talent can be passed down via genetics. He's a producer, book writer, songwriter, and just released a new album, which we play on the station, so I know it's really good, as well as backing tracks, which I'm curious about. We're going to talk about that as well. Let's answer all of those questions by welcoming to the show, Robbie Sherman. Robbie, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you so much for having me, Jean-Paul.
Awesome. So before we get into everything, I always like to get the 30-second bio of my guests. Not everybody might know who I'm talking to. So in 30 seconds, who is Robbie Sherman?
Start the clock now. Exactly. As I always say, you know, my father, I come from a long line of famous songwriters. I don't know that I'm quite that famous yet, but my great-grandfather was a court composer and a concertmaster and conductor for Emperor Franz Joseph of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. My grandfather, his Samuel Sherman's son, was a Tin Pan Alley songwriter, wrote songs for the likes of Frank Sinatra, Billie Holiday, Bing Crosby, Marie Chevalier, Ella Fitzgerald, and really the list goes on, and Benny Goodman, you name it, and really everybody and everything. And then the most famous in the bunch was my father and uncle, the Sherman brothers, who famously wrote for Walt Disney, Mary Poppins and The Jungle Book and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which wasn't Disney, but it was a great movie. Bedknobs and Broomsticks, and the most translated and performed song on earth, It's a Small World After All. When I was very small, one of the things I realized is that my father and uncle were writing this music that people my age liked. And so I was immediately drawn to it. You know, if you're Mick Jagger's kid and he's writing something as a three-year-old or a five-year-old, you might not necessarily care so much about that type of music. But my dad was writing the kind of stuff that I appreciated and that I loved. And so to me, this was the greatest kind of music writing. And I literally, if I have a famous quote, and I don't, but the most quoted thing from me is that when I was that my earliest memory was that I wanted to be a songwriter. And it's a strange thing to call an earliest memory, because usually a desire is not a memory, but it was. I remember my father had come home with the acetate record for Snoopy Come Home, and he played it for us, and it was music that I could appreciate as a two-year-old, and I was dancing around the room to this music. I remember it distinctly, and thinking, and I believe my grandfather was over as well. He was still alive then, and it was like it's a little bit like Simba in The Lion King saying, "I just can't wait to be king. One day this mountain would be mine." And that's much more than 30 seconds, but there you go.
That's okay. You had a few generations of stuff to get through.
Well, that's my background. Let me give you a little bit more about me. So then, when I was 18 years old, I wrote a musical that played at the Beverly Hills Playhouse. I'm from Los Angeles. That's where I was born and raised. And I'm unusual in that my musical legacy is not out of New York. It's actually, although my dad and uncle were born in New York, they came to LA because they were doing film musicals, and they were really the only people in the 1960s still doing original film musicals. There were still some made, but they were usually adaptations like Oliver or West Side Story. These were adaptations of stage musicals, but the very rare thing in the 60s was this idea of the film musical, and that was something that I so I got the good weather of LA in my blood, as opposed to say an Adam Gittle or somebody like that who had to put frostbite protection on, you know, on his way to music school. And so I wrote my first musical, A Christmas Held Captive, with a collaborator named Chris Dawson back in 1986. That was that played at the Beverly Hills Playhouse. Since I did a little bit of TV and movies, and I started working on my own music. I collaborated with my father on a script for an animation project that the Sherman Brothers wrote some songs for. And it's actually something we're bringing back to life right now, called Incus the Ramphorhynchus. And then when we moved to London, when I moved with my father to London, in 2002, 20 years ago, I realized that this was a great place for me to be, because this is really, you know, New York and London, Toronto too, but really it's New York and London's West End, where brand new musicals are born and incubated and grown, and then go out to the rest of the world. And this was the place to be. So I was able to learn at my father's side in very much an apprenticeship kind of a way. And it's very much the type of relationship I think should be nurtured and fostered in songwriting more, and I'm very much an advocate of. There's a lot of mentorship, but there's not a lot of apprenticeship, and that's something that I'm a big advocate of.
Very cool.
Sorry, you may need to cut this part down a bit. So I keep on sort of diverging, but
I'm okay with that sort of thing, you know, because it's a good way to get to know the person I'm talking with.
The problem is, I'm not 100 years old, but but there is 100 years of history I'm talking. Actually, 120 years of history, yeah. I'm talking about, So then in 2014, I produced actually a tribute concert to my father, who'd passed away a year and a half earlier, called A Spoonful of Sherman. That ended up playing several times in London and then we did a stage musical version of what started off as a cabaret kind of a show. And that actually, we did a 25 city tour of UK and Ireland in 2018. And then it went to Singapore and to San Jose, California, amongst other places, in 2019. Then, of course, there's the pandemic. In 2015, my show Lovebirds was a hit of the town in Edinburgh at the Fringe Festival. That's a show we're looking to bring back in a two-act version for West End, hopefully in the near future. And have some very big plans for that, actually. And then my show Bumble Scratch, which is about the plague of London and the Great Fire. It starts with the plague, ends with the fire. You know, perfect musical, cheerful subject matter. And it's told from the point of view of a drunken, lascivious plague rat named Melbourne Bumble Scratch. To him, it was a golden era. And so Lovebirds is about parrots and penguins singing in a vaudeville show. So that gives you kind of a taste. And I'm working on a few other projects at the same time as well. So that is your 4 minute, 5 minute. I don't know. Is our hour done now? Sorry. Please feel free to cut that down if you need
to. Nope, because like I said, I love knowing about someone. If it takes a little bit longer, so be it. So we got to know who you are. Before we talk about the songbook and stuff, I do want to take it back, because obviously it was in your genes. You said you wanted to write when you were young, and you've always known you wanted to do that. But I'm always curious, is there something else you kind of wanted to do as a life, maybe as a secondary career, or something that also tickled your fancy growing up? Because I'm always curious if there was something else you wanted to do, maybe.
So one thing that I would be probably very poor at, but it was something as a boy I really wanted to do. But I think in hindsight, I'm glad I'm not doing it. I don't think I have the stomach for it, to be honest with you, was politics. I remember I said to I was born in 68. And I remember in the early 80s, maybe when I was 12 years old, I said to my mom that I wanted to one day be president of the United States. And the late 60s and the 70s have been a very cynical time, and in America and in American politics. And my mom and my dad were very surprised, pleasantly surprised to hear, because, you know, in the 50s, in the early 60s, you know, that was kind of an American boy's ambition. So that was the thing. Also, I love architecture. I still love looking at architecture. Hobbies that I've had, coin collecting. I don't know that that's really a career unless you sell coins as a career, I suppose. But I have many, many interests. History. My dad and I probably, if we didn't come from this world, probably would have been some sort of academics, I think. I think we both, although that would not have been what I would have thought I would have gone into in my teens or 20s. But by my late 20s, I think I probably would have gone back to school to become a historian or something.
That's cool. Yeah. Like I said, I'm always interested in the other facets of a person because they would bring a person a whole, make them whole. It helps with your writing. It helps with everything else you do in life.
Well, it's more than that as well. I agree with you 100%. And, there's I have a theory about this. I think, especially with lyricists, lyricists come to their writing, to their craft in a particular way. So for example, Stephen Sondheim, the late great Stephen Sondheim, I would argue came to his craft as a mathematician. That was his prior passion, and he loved math and he loved making crossword puzzles, and he saw it and he approached it as a series of lists and the like, and that songwriting is lyric writing is creating a series of lists. I would say that my father and Oscar Hammerstein both came to songwriting, and this is unusual actually, as poets, which probably is where you should come from if you're a lyricist, ideally, because they espoused a philosophy, and their philosophy resonated in their writing. You'll never walk alone. It's a small world after all, which is my dad's song. Obviously, the former is Hammerstein, and then you have somebody who's the serial monogamist in Alan J. Lerner. He loved women, and he loved loving women, and the next woman, and the next woman, and the next woman, and he was. They say the serial monogamist, although one wonders if there wasn't brief moments of non-monogamy that would have necessitated the six or seven wives. But he was, but if you look at the shows that he wrote, whether it was Gigi and Thank Heaven for Little Girls or Lolita, which obviously was a bit darker, he was attracted to that. And also, I think you're wise to look at that, because I do think that the lyricist, especially musicians too, the composer as well, but lyricists especially, come to their craft from an angle. And those are some of the angles I could go on. I could go on my list because the list goes on, but that gives you a brief summary of that.
Yeah. My lady friend asked me, why are you watching that? Why are you reading that? Because I say, because I need to know everything. Because the more you know, the better you can be at whatever you're doing. You're writing.
Are you a writer?
I have written shows. I don't do it so much anymore because I'm helping others instead, which makes me just as happy. So,
well, yeah. we others appreciate it very much. So, thank you.
No problem. So, when you were like, I want to look at this. When you were 16, you were one of the youngest songwriters in BMI. What was that like to be a teenager? I know when I was 16, I wasn't writing musicals and doing that sort of thing.
So I have to be humble on this moment. Okay. So the reason was it was all connections. Basically, I was. There was a lovely friend of my parents named Thea Zavin. I believe she was vice president of legal affairs at BMI and very, very high up at BMI. For those listeners who don't know, they're the royalty collection agency in America, in the United States, them and ASCAP. And my brother, who is 11 years older than I am, had written a couple songs for a TV show. But I was the passionate one about songwriting. That was always my thing. And so my brother needed to get an affiliation because otherwise he couldn't collect a royalty. And so Thea said to my dad, said, well, look, if we're going to put Jeff in BMI, why don't we do Robbie at the same time? That's all that. But of course, that does make it into my CV. But and I was writing songs, and I was very passionate. I was already at that point, I'd done student film musicals that won awards, and including The Dog of Darkness, which I'm sure you've seen many times, and The 9-Minute Spectacle and Super 8 Millimeter, and of course, The Magic Tuba, both musicals. And they're both Award of Distinction winners from the LA Student Film Institute. Anyways, but that was not the reason. It was because of family connections that I got into BMI at such a young age.
But to be able to stick around, right? It's one thing to be able to get in, but if you have the talent to stick around, that's the key. Right. Sometimes you just need a door open, but it's, you got to be able to walk through it and stay there. So,
well, you know,
you obviously can do that.
You know, I was just talking with my associate Elliot, who sorted everything out about this. You know, what is talent? And, you know, people talk about talent as though, and I think talent, when people speak about talent, they say talent is a God-given gift. If you don't believe in God, say the universe gave it to the molecules assembled in such a way. You don't have to believe in God to, but
yeah,
for shortcut sake, let's just say it's a God-given gift. This is my take on talent. There's a lot of things that are talent. You know, you might not be naturally the best linguist. You may not be naturally the best musician or composer, but talent can just be the desire. And I think actually many times, certainly with me, I don't think that I'm necessarily the natural lyricist or a natural composer, but I definitely am I have a natural desire for these things. Like I said, my earliest desire that I remember, my earliest memory was that I wanted to write songs. So to me, that's also a talent. Generosity can be a talent. You know, if a person doesn't have a generous soul, they not only can't give, but they also have struggled to receive. And they tend to be very lonely people. So the idea of generosity itself as an aspect, an attribute of a person's personality, that's also a talent. So I would say, and I think it's an important concept because, you know, just because you aren't the world's great musician, but if you really want a thing, you know, especially in the days of YouTube where, you know, you can watch a 7-minute video on how to do anything, you can learn how to do it.
Nope. Well, let's talk about your talent and your skills, and let's talk about the songbook that Robbie Sherman songbook that just came out. So tell us a little bit, what was the impetus for this? And tell us a little bit about the show.
Shameless plug.
For the podcasters, he's holding up the piano and vocal book.
That's so. Right. Yeah. The songbook actually is in many different iterations. There are 16 songs in my songbook. It's also available, and probably more will sell on the digital, I think it already has, than on the physical. And I'm not even sure at the moment if we have a way to purchase this, although they will be for sale and available in Canada and in the United States and also in the UK. And there are songs that I wrote, 16 songs from different shows that I've written, about 5 different shows. And I specifically chose them after having a good day, but it was a frustrating day. I felt bad for one of the performers who had really chosen a terrible song. It was a young performer who was trying out for my show Bumble Scratch, and this young fellow chose a song by Rihanna. Well, you know, great song, but it's a pop song. And the problem with a pop song is a pop song doesn't have the necessary dramatic arc that a musical theater song almost always does have. Even the best written pop songs don't have this thing of a dramatic arc. And I'm a big believer that one of the problems is that a lot of these jukebox musicals is that there's an artificial, you have to artificially create a dramatic arc in at which you can do, but it is a bit clumsy, and it's not really great dramaturgy if to do this. The idea is you need to be in a different place emotionally. The main character needs to be in a different place from where he started in a song. a song is nothing more, nothing less than a musicalized scene in a musical theater context. And so what I did is I chose 16 songs of mine, actually not all of the songs I would say, but some of them are better than others for this, that specifically would be good for auditions in different ways. Some have a better dramatic arc. Some are good patter songs, especially with song with shows and modern shows like Hamilton, where you have these, where you have, you know, hip hop and rap, although I don't really write that, patter is a good audition piece for that. And if you only get one song to do, you also want to show some tonality in your performance, because, you know, if you're rapping, you might not, although it does have tone, it's not necessarily as obvious, because there's going to be moments, even if you're in Hamilton, maybe they want you for the King George part, which is very tonal. So I chose different songs, with different comedy songs, very dramatically stark songs, where I have one recitative, which has called That Something from my show Bumble Scratch, where the character starts off very angry, then is recalcitrant and feels a lot of shame, but then is so filled with love for this girl that he is willing to betray his previous loyalties. And all of that happens in 2 minutes. It's a good short song. It's a lot of dramatic arc. It takes a lot of musicality. I wouldn't recommend this to a first time auditioner, but if they're very musical and have a good room, but I'm telling you, if somebody performed this song well, they'd get the part, whatever that part was. So that's the kind of songs that I wanted to include in the songbook.
When you're writing, I'm always curious with the writers, do you find one is easier than the other, the lyrics or the music, or do you find they're both about the same and they come to you at the same time? How do you write a song?
Not as formally as my father would do it, my father and uncle. But they had a pat answer to what comes first, the music or the lyrics, mm-hmm. which isn't your question. I realize that, but yep. What's harder? But they would always say there's a third component, and that's the idea. And in musical theater, I think the idea is very important, because again, it's all you're doing in creating a song for musical theater is, there's a lot of other things really. It's not just this, but with musical theater, you're really creating a musicalized scene. So, it's what's harder. I don't know. I think the melody lines tend to be more straightforward for me to write. That said, oftentimes I'll be taking a walk and I'll come up with a melody line and in my head, and you know, I'll scramble to remember it, you know, come back home, but I can't play it. Yeah. And I'm always relieved after I've done the demo session. Because sometimes it's so much, it takes up so much gray matter. I can't do anything until I've downloaded all of that music and then had it transcribed. And, you know, and so that, okay, now if something were to happen to me, that's not, you know, that time wasn't wasted. And I put that there. So what's harder? Probably lyrics. I can really struggle with lyrics for months sometimes. Even every day. I'm not talking about like, I don't revisit. I've written songs that have taken me 2-3 months to write, and that's working every day for 4 to 6 hours on it. So. Yeah.
No, it's sometimes it's just something, some skills are just a little easier. They come just so much and they flow out so much easier. And the other ones, not that you can't do it. It's just a little bit harder, right?
Also, I'm of the school that melody should follow the lyrical thought. So for example, Rodgers and Hammerstein, South Pacific, Some Enchanted Evening. Hammerstein famously wrote the lyrics first, and then Rodgers would compose the music. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in a way, he had a very easy job, because Some Enchanted Evening, now say that with just a little more emphasis, Some Enchanted Evening, Some Enchanted Evening. I mean, the melody is right there. Now, don't get me wrong. I think Rodgers added his personality to those songs tremendously, and there was the idea of the, you might say, the introvert and extrovert in not that that's strictly their personality types, but Rodgers was more flamboyant. And, you know, I always like to use the example of The Sound of Music. You know, you talk about a great piece of poetry. We're talking about Hammerstein as a poet and his approach. The hills are alive with the sound of music, with songs they have sung for 1,000 years. I go to the hills when my heart is lonely. I know I will hear what I've heard before. My heart will be blessed with the sound of music, and I'll sing once more. It takes a really pushy, bold as brass guy to take that genius poetry, you know, Coleridge level poetry, and write dun dun da 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 da. And I mean, you think about that, it's an amazing thought, because a lesser composer would have written, "The hills are alive with the sound of music," you know, and it would have been a very gentle trip along, you know, kind of a song, like the lyric. But the lyric isn't trip along, it's this magnificent soul, you find yourself in nature, lyric, and how that's, and in the way that only Hammerstein could make, make a small microcosm aspect of a story, the macro, and the idea of being in nature and connecting to the naturalness of the world, just like the song, it's that wonderful song, which is a metaphor for modern history at the time, which was there's a sad sort of clanging the clock, and it's all about Hitler invading and the cuckoo and is so long farewell, and it seems like a charming little exit, and of course it was their exit from the place, you know, from the waking world.
Yeah. Wow. Let's talk a little bit more about the songbook itself. I mentioned that there's backing tracks available. Tell us a little bit about that. I'm curious.
So when we talk about the songbook, there's several ways to explore. There's the sheet music. We have physical sheet music, and then there's the digital sheet music, which is available at, what is Sheet Music Direct? Is that the website, I think? Yeah. And I'll give you a link as well. Sure. That you can find all of these things. It's sort of a portal page on my company's music page. It's www.shermantheatrical.com/music, and all of the songbook iterations. So you have the sheet music, both physical and digital, and you can buy individual pieces of sheet music that way. There's also audio songbook, which has already been released, which has the 16 songs, and they're been recorded by 16 different West End performers, including the Olivier Award winner from 2020 for Dear Evan Hansen, Sam Tutty, and Rachel John, who is in Hamilton, and A Girl from the North Country. We have Rob Houchin, who's been in Les Mis and is about to go into South Pacific, I think. And literally another 13 or so wonderful performers, Evie Hoskins, you know, I mean, the list goes on, and I'm forgetting names. Ilan Galkoff. I mean, yeah, it's terrible. And I can just see, I can see their faces looking at me, not say my name on radio. And they were kind enough to assist me and record the songs, so that there'd be an example for the young performers who take it. So that's available on all of the audio things, whether it's Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music. And then the third way that you can experience my songs is through the sheet music. There's the audio, all the audio platforms, digital audio. There are no physical CDs. The only thing physical that we are selling at the moment is the physical songbook. And then the third thing is the videos. And there's about 11 videos with these wonderful West End rising stars. They're all on YouTube. Some of them have done extremely well. Sam Tutty was over 150,000 views within the first month on YouTube, and on TikTok he was well over a million. So that was, and it's probably growing even more since then. So please do check that stuff out, and you can find all those links on the ShermanTheatricals.com/music webpage.
For sure. And we'll be sharing that on our
now. Yeah. And so that's the first release was To go to your question, I'm sorry. I know I go on a tangent.
That's okay.
I get there. My mother used to say, Robbie, you know, somebody asks you what time it is and you tell them how the clock is made. which my answer is, but you know, that's going to be their next question. How do you make that clock? How does that work? Anyways. And so, so what I decided to do, again, this is meant to be sort of a premier tool for young performers, who want new and interesting audition material. And you don't know how many times you go to an audition when you're on the other side of the footlights and you see somebody come up there and it's the 17th time you've heard X song because they got a brief, a very similar brief, probably from the producers, but that doesn't help the performer. And when a performer comes up there with something maybe you haven't heard before or an unusual choice that works, that perks your ears and eyes and you're willing to look at that person a little closer. So, but not everybody has a pianist at their disposal. And so what we did is we decided to also create a backing tracks and vocal guides album. There's literally 70 tracks. There's different keys. So they're like, if a song is good for a baritone, we also have it for a tenor or for mezzo there's a song that's a duet on there called The Dream I Never Dreamed. Lovely ballad. And it's a duet but you can also sing it as a solo piece. And those versions are both available, or there's many different versions available. And then there's also there's a piano backing track in the different keys, and it tells you what the different keys are. And then there's also vocal guides. So it's the same piano backing track, but it also gives you a tutorial. So it plunks out the note. There's no bouncing ball because it's not visual, but you know, between that and then watching the video and the sheet music, even if you don't read music per se, you should be able to muddle your way through learning the song, I would think.
You know, all this stuff is really fantastic because like you said, I've been on the other side of the desk and yeah. I understand how hard it is for someone to come in who doesn't know how to read music, but loves to sing and wants to perform, but just doesn't have a pianist to play this. So what you've created is just incredible for all those people who want to get into it. And you've knocked down barriers that you know, keep out a percentage of people. So great on you. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Well, I wanted to make this accessible for people I have a letter in the front. It's a letter specifically to young musical theater performers. And it's people who are auditioning. I mean, I hope that, frankly, I hope that everybody gets a chance to listen to it. Certainly, I think it's material that's good for all musical theater people. Mm-hmm. I anybody who's just an enthusiast, I think, would hopefully enjoy something of mine. And there's some nice stuff there. But I think for auditionees, there's I give some advice in the front of the book as well. And I also give a summary of what the shows are about and what each song is in the scenario that you find it, so that an actor will have a chance, an opportunity to interpret the song with context.
Yeah. And that is another thing that's very difficult, especially for new performers coming out. You know, for some of us who've been, around, we either can know how to interpret it already, or we put our own spin on it. But when you're new, knowing how to do any of that stuff is really difficult. So just being able to go to your thing, having the backing tracks, being able to follow along, knowing the plot, it's a nice self-contained all-in-one thing for a new performer. And again, it'd be great if other writers did that, just the backing tracks alone.
It's hard. Look, it's not without expense, and it's not without without being time consuming. It was definitely a process, especially during COVID, doing a lot of this preparation. I mean, we would have recording sessions that were these weird remote things where you weren't in the same room, with the engineer, and it was nuts. But it was but I'm glad we did it. And and in a couple of the videos you can even see, because we did some during COVID times, and It's loosened up a lot in London. I don't know what it's like in Toronto, but
it's starting to loosen up here too. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, thank God it looks like we're coming around the bend on this thing.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Where can people find the songbook outside of your website, all the places that people can get?
Well, so like, again, it's available on all, you look on Amazon Music, it's available all these places. But again, the easiest way to find it, I think, would be through the website. And then whatever a person's comfortable with, if they want to buy the songs or listen to samples, look, you know, you go to YouTube and you can hear this stuff for free. If you want to download the music, it's a couple dollars, couple pounds to buy the sheet music. We're building the distribution of this as we speak. So next week, not sure when you're airing this, but next week, so March 22nd, I think we're releasing album 2, which is the backing tracks and vocal guides. So nice. That's when that's released. And there's also, we're going to be down the line doing a third album, which is the alternative takes, because like I said, there, some songs are designed for, some versions are designed for male voices, some for female voices, unchanged boy's voice or a changed male voice. Yeah. So, you know, you have different vocal styles, and what's a good song for that type of a person, you know, going through whatever they're going through in their lives, what makes a good choice for a song. And those are all topics explored, and you know, the most important thing is that you as the performer have to convince us that you can pull off the part. So, you know, it's, you can do something unconventional, but understand that at the end of the day, it's a risk you're taking, and, you know, this, and, you know, and that's, but that's sometimes a really great thing. And so that's one of the things that I encourage, because like I said, all of that sheet music, I think there's something like, for 16 songs, I think there's 33 different pieces of sheet music that are currently on sale, because, you know, like I said, the different ranges of vocal types and duet, solo, we have one that's a trio. So
you've put a lot of thought and time into this, and it shows, and it's a fantastic thing. And again, I have to say congratulations on,
thank you,
on doing something a little bit different, unique, and most importantly, helpful. It's going to make such a difference.
It's great. Well, you know, and I hope that people will sign up to our mailing list on the website as well, so that they can be the first to hear some of the big things that we're doing with Sherman Theatrical. That's the other big thing that we're doing right now was one of my lockdown concepts and a project that we're bringing to fruition. It was the summer of 2020. And I wrote up I was talking to a friend of mine who does investment relations named Andrew Kaplan. And I said to him, Andrew, what do you, you know, I'm in this odd position with my family, and, you know, on a, I represent half of the Sherman Brothers estate. You know, there's things of my dad's that we could be exploiting. There's things of mine. What would you think, you know, if you had a company that, instead of, you know, the risky venture of doing a musical, but if you could mitigate that risk by crossing, you know, by having several projects invested in one time, what would you, you know, and he said, that's a great, I was thinking he was going to shoot it down. I'm not a finance guy. And he said, no, it's a good idea. I'll write up something. So, okay, how much do you want? It's just a couple paragraphs, 3 pages maximum. I went away 2 weeks later. I came back with 46 pages, because what I wanted to do, I wanted to talk about all the different projects, the pros, the cons, whether I thought it was a sure thing we'd get it. Maybe it was a great project, but we might not, you know, we don't have the rights, but we could ask the people for the right, you know, all the different, the whole story. So it'd be about 3 pages on each project to give a person the beginning, you know, a Bible on the projects that we would look at first. Yeah. And, 'cause I think we looked at like 11 projects, and, And we put this together, and it's just built and built. And we had a very successful financial raise. We're in the middle of one right now, a second one, and that's going well. And so that's where we are. In fact, one of the two co-CEOs is a Torontonian. Thank you. Sorry about that. Torontonian. His name is Brett Golden, and he works in the finance sphere right in your hometown.
Nice. Well, when something comes of that, you'll have to come back on and tell us all about that as well. And
well, I'm sure he's going to be listening, so I had to mention his name. It's going to be another thing. I've got all these folks working in the company. Well, why didn't you mention me? And their names I actually do have at the top of my head because I get texts from them all day long. So that's the
hardest thing, isn't it? Once you open that Pandora's box of one name, you kind of have to get them all out. But it's so hard because
if I ever win a big award, I think I say, these are the people I'm not going to thank.
Yeah, exactly. Robbie, thank you so much for coming on today and telling us more about yourself, about the songbook, the incredible what you did with that. So thank you so much for coming on. Before we go, I always ask three questions of my guests. There's no right or wrong answer, but we'll get to know you a little bit more. This first one might be, for other people, it's a little bit easier. For you, might be a little more difficult. All right, question number one. What creator or team within musical theater has had a great influence on you? Could be a composer, lyricist, director, producer, actor, stage manager even. Could be somebody famous or not famous, like a teacher. Is there somebody within musical theater has had a great influence on you? Obviously there is, but...
Well, you could guess from listening to this podcast. I would say my father and uncle, my Walt Disney himself. I would say Al Sherman, my grandfather. I would say Stephen Sondheim. I would say Rodgers and Hammerstein. In the songwriting world, those are easy ones. I could also name Stephen Schwartz and even Mencken and Ashman, interestingly, considering they sort of took over where my dad and uncle left off. That's a good list, I think. Oh, yeah. Lennon and McCartney. I must remember Lennon and McCartney.
For sure. All of them are correct answers. You can't go wrong with any of those answers.
So. I can think of a couple that wouldn't be. But I don't want to get in trouble.
1 point for you for that. 1 point. Question number two. You've written songs for the film Inca, of course, right? And you wrote stage musicals The Penguin Pirate and Lovebirds. Now, do you have an affinity for writing for birds? Because there seems to be a theme there.
Or yeah, are you just Incas, by the way, is a flying dinosaur, although I didn't come up with that character. Okay. He's like a small pterodactyl. Incas the Ramphorhynchus was a character my father created back in 1951. And when I first started a production company for film, not for theater, we were looking at projects that maybe we wanted to work with my father and uncle on. And that was one that was sitting there, and it just was a beautiful project. So we acquired it and we did a ton of work on it. We even went as far as doing a full animatic so you could actually watch the whole thing. We had a great crew of people, but do I like birds? Yes. I think birds are hilarious. I think they're funny the way they walk. I think also in the case of penguins and parrots, there's qualities in both that are so human-like. They just loan themselves to interesting. And I just think birds are amazing creatures, very colorful in more ways than one.
What other bird do you think would make a good musical? Like as a lead character?
Well, I've got flamingos. I think a lot of them would. Owls. Yeah. Yeah. I think owls are great. Great personalities. Flamingos, of course, and I've got those in Lovebirds. I've got any of the ones with the big bills. Puffins. I mean, you know, they're all funny. Pigeons. There was that animated film about 15 years ago about the pigeon who. The carrier pigeon. I mean, they're interesting. They're fascinating creatures. They're absolutely fascinating creatures.
Very nice. Another correct answer. Another point. All right. One more question.
Storks.
Storks are awesome. Yeah. Food in the theater or cell phones in the theater? Which is worse?
Oh, cell phones. Food in the theater, I have no problem with, as long as people are human beings and don't disturb other people with it. I don't mind food in the theater at all. I think that's great. But obviously, if they're going to, you know, masticate with noises available to the, you know, to the whole world, that's going to be, and I said masticate.
Yes.
I was wondering, chew loudly. But yeah, but that's a problem. But I think otherwise, no, food is great. Why not?
Have you had a bad cell phone experience in the theater?
Sure. Anybody? Yeah. Somebody who have a cell phone going on. It's kind of, why have you?
Actually, I don't know if I have. It's been so long since I've been in the theater, to be honest.
I mean, I'm somebody who will leave his house without his cell phone. I don't like to be tethered to a cell phone. Personally, I remember the day a business partner of mine said, if you don't get a cell phone, we're not going to stay in business. This is in the late 90s, when people first started to get cell phones pretty much regularly. And I thought to myself, you know, I mean, I did it, but, you know, I used to love to get into my car and just drive around, and that was freedom to not be at your desk. Nowadays, we live in this world, especially during all the lockdowns, where we're tethered to our social media. And I think it's terrible. You see kids, adults, forget kids. It's not just kids, adults who sit in what should be a social gathering, and they're affixed, you know, to their phone and to their screen. And I think it's good to have screen-free days. I haven't done this yet, but I actually would like to go to actually Canada. I have a friend who lives in the west coast of Canada, where they're in this particular area, you can't get cell phone reception. And to me, the idea of not being able to subscribe to the attention, I actually don't care about my cell phone as much as having internet connection, because I use dictionaries and rhyming dictionaries and things like that for my songwriting with my laptop. And that's something that thesauri, and I just think, if that's the word, is it thesaurus or thesauruses or thesauri?
I don't know.
I don't know if that's one of the words that you would pluralize by making it I, like, anyways. So I think that the answer is, I don't like the idea that somebody would not turn off their phone. Because that I find disturbing. What do you find most disturbing?
Cell phones are disruptive to stage and audience. Food is just disruptive to the ushers who have to clean up afterwards, because people are animals, like you said, and just leave garbage everywhere, right? I walk out at the end of the show and there's cups and stuff on the ground. I'm like, people, come on.
It's very funny. In my show Lovebirds, one of the plot situations is that somebody, there's this new fad, and it's all about parrots and penguins singing in a vaudeville show.
Yeah.
And somebody has gotten, somebody's eating these crackers in the audience, and you can hear, and because Balthazar is a macaw, he's sort of a washed up opera singer. And he's playing in this vaudeville house, but he grabs a crowd, but he's obviously not playing in an opera house anymore. And he hears this crunching of a cracker. Because he's a parrot, that drives him up the wall, and he storms out. So he would agree with you. My parrot would agree with you, but that's a character in the show. But for me, food is not a problem. I think it's the bigger issue isn't the bigger issue just the cultural education of people that theater is a temple, and it should be a place where we receive this wonderful gift of theater, not a place. I don't mind if you eat, but just do it respectfully. I don't mind if you bring in your phone, turn off the darn phone.
Yeah. You know what? 2 points for that correct answer. Both are terrible.
I'm giving a lot of points here. You know,
congratulations. 4 points out of 3. I have no prizes, but you can brag to everybody that you won the game.
Prizes being here with you.
Wow. I'd take the rice-a-roni over me, the lifetime supply. Robbie, thank you again so much for coming on the show, telling us more about your songbook, the backing tracks, all the stuff that you're doing. And it was a pleasure to meet you and have you on the show.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. All right. We were just speaking with Robbie Sherman, who's just released the Robbie Sherman songbook. Will you be able to find that as website? We'll promote it on our social media as well. Tune in next week as we'll speak with another guest or guests about their life, love, and passion. That is musical theater. I am your host, as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. And until next time, I'll see you when I see you.